All right, so so basically, we calculated the Broglie wavelength by considering a non-interacting gas or particles. And we say, well, if the non-interacting gas would have a de Broglie wavelength, which is larger than the distance between the particles, then it's going to be a quantum system. Then, of course, when I put in the interactions, then you cannot really define a de Broglie wavelength for an interacting system. But I knew it was a quantum system before I turned on interactions, so I call it a quantum many-valence system. So suppose I have a number of particles, and then the thing is at a temperature T, then I know that the kinetic energy of my system, which is the momentum squared of any given particle divided by twice the mass of the particles, is going to be of order Boltzmann's constant times the temperature. That's the thermal energy of the system, right? And I also know that the momentum of a particle is the Planck's constant divided by its wavelength, right? That's the Broglie wave-particle duality. So therefore, from these two equations, I can very simply deduce that the Broglie wavelength is h over p, and p is the square root of 2mkt. Right? So that's Planck's constant, which is 10 to the minus 34 times 6. That's the mass of the particle. That's the Boltzmann's constant, which is 10 to the minus 23. And that's the temperature, right? So the mass of the particles and the temperature determine the Broglie wavelength, right? And that has to be compared to the number density of particles. Let's call that n. And the number density of particles can be written as Rs to the minus 1/3. So where this defines Rs, which is a kind of average separation between the particles, right? So you have to imagine you put each particle in a little cube, okay? And then that tells you basically the distance to the adjacent particle. Of course, the particles are not in a cube, so it's just an average, right? So therefore, the comparison you have to do is between Rs, which is one over n to the one, sorry, I did that wrong, didn't I? It's 2 minus 3. Right, the volume around one particle, you invert it, and that gives you the number density. So so therefore, Rs is 1 over n to the 1/3, right? Okay, and then that has to be compared to the Broglie wavelength, which is h over square root of 2mkBT. So for a given density, for example, if the particles are very light, m is very small, then the Broglie wavelength will be very big and eventually becomes bigger than Rs. Or if I just cool it down to very low temperatures, right? So examples of, and you know, it's very useful to actually calculate these two things for a number of systems. So consider liquid water and take each quantum particle to be one water molecule. Then the mass of the water molecule is 16 plus 2, 18 atomic units. And then it's very easy to see that, for example, at room temperature, water definitely is not a quantum system, because the Broglie wavelength is much, much smaller than the distance between. That's not to say that, for example, the spectrum of the individual water molecule is not ruled by quantum mechanics, but that's because it's ruled by the quantum mechanics of the electrons that are inside it. But when you look at how water molecules interact with each other, they basically behave like classical objects. But if you, for example, put in here the mass of a helium atom, which is 4 atomic mass units, and you cool it down to 5 Kelvin or something like that, then you will see that the Broglie wavelengths overlap. And in fact, helium, that's the most special things about thing about helium. Well, there are many special things about helium, but perhaps the most special one is that the only natural quantum fluid, because you can cool down helium to 4 Kelvin, which is where it boils, 4.2 Kelvin, and below that temperature is a liquid down to the lowest temperatures we can achieve. And at those temperatures, you can work out from this that the Broglie wavelengths strongly overlap. And that's why helium-4 undergoes Bose-Einstein condensation, and helium-3 undergoes a superfluid transition at much lower temperatures. Now, every other naturally occurring fluid will freeze well above the temperature at which the de Broglie wavelength would start to be significant. So helium is the only quantum fluid. In fact, helium doesn't freeze at all at ambient pressure. You can, as far as we know. And that's because the quantum fluctuations are so strong that they keep it fluid. But for example, even if you go to the other noble gases, like neon, the atom is already too heavy. So the de Broglie wavelength is too small. You don't get a quantum fluid. But the most important example of a quantum fluid, just to finish with atoms, what about ultra-cold gases? You can have extremely cold gases which are also quantum fluids, and they are made of very heavy atoms like rubidium or krypton. And the way that is achieved is, of course, this is very big, so that makes the Broglie wavelength small, but you put them at incredibly low temperatures. And you will say, well, how can you do that? Because then they'll freeze, right? Rubidium is certainly a solid. And the point is that you keep it very low density. If it's very low density, then it takes very long to freeze because you need the particles to stick to each other, and that takes some time. So for several minutes, it's still a gas, it hasn't frozen, and it is well in the quantum regime, okay? But the most important example of a quantum fluid are electrons. Electrons have a mass which is 10 to the 3 to 10 to the, well, 10 to the 4 times lighter than a typical atom. Okay? And that means that even at 300 Kelvin, the de Broglie wavelength is actually very big. Okay? So in fact, if you take typical densities for a metal, say the interparticle distance, is 2 or 3 angstroms, and you can very easily calculate what would be the temperature for which an electron's de Broglie wavelength would be that small, and it's like 10,000 Kelvin. So electrons in metals are strongly in the quantum regime, and that is the reason why all these points of view have been developed, because to understand anything about metals you need to take into account the symmetry properties of the wave function. Right, and I would encourage you as a kind of exercise to do these numbers, to take, you know, the periodic table and see which, convince yourselves whether helium-3, helium-4 can be quantum fluids, and what the combination of density and temperature has to be for krypton or for rubidium to be a quantum fluid, and also convince yourselves that for any reasonable density of electrons in a metal, electrons will always have a very long de Broglie wavelength, okay? Right, and after this process, I'm going to just introduce the very basic idea of second quantization, and then we'll see. Right, so the basic idea is that the basic idea is the following. I want to create some quantum mechanical operator that allow me to describe states by the quantum labels, single particle states that are occupied, and then take me from one of those states to another. So I define something called Fock space. Technically, Fock space is a direct sum of the Hilbert spaces of first a state with one part, a system with one particle, a system with two particles, and a system with three, and so on. And then in each of these Hilbert spaces, I have this Slater determinants. But actually, it's perhaps easier to simply think of it operationally. So first, let's still within first quantization, use a slightly better notation than these wave functions by using kets. So I'm going to call my state with one particle with wave vector k1 like that, and my state with two particles with wave vectors k1 and k2, something like that. Okay, so you can see, and I put the square root of 2 in the front to normalize. This is exactly what I wrote before, but I'm just not bothering with writing the positions. But I'm still labeling the particles because that refers to the first particle, that to the second. First particle, second. So you can tell from the fact that the labels are inverted that whereas here the first particle was in state k1, here is state k2. And I'm also going to do something else to simplify matters further, which is that, again, just as I've done away with the positions of the particles, I'm also going to stop talking about wave vectors, because just as I was using wave vectors as my single particle states, I could also have had a lattice model, for example, modeling a solid where the particles are strongly localized about specific positions, and then my single particle Hamiltonian could have been one where also there's no hopping from side to side. So then my starting states could be just eigenstates of where I am, so side index. So instead of wave vectors, I would be giving side indices. So the first particle is on the first side, the second particle is on the second side, the third particle is on the fifth side, or something like that. So let's just break away from this kind of specific language of wave vectors and just say, well, I have some single particle states, and I'm just saying here that the first particle is in the first state. Here, the first particle is in the first state, and the second particle is in the third state, and so on. Okay, is what I've done here understood, or has this notation become a little bit too abstract to be useful? I can keep the case if that's more comfortable. Let's have a show of hands. Shall I keep the wave vectors, talking about wave vectors? Or shall I keep it a bit more abstract? So these labels could be wave vectors, or they could be side indices, or they could be, I don't know, spin states, or whatever. You prefer that? I need a real show of hands. This or the earlier? Come on, who's for this? Okay, I'm sorry, we're going there. So imagine, if you are finding it hard to make the leap, just imagine this is K1, this is K3. K3, K1. Okay? Right, so this is still first quantized notation. So now, how do I go from here to there? So let me define an operator, which is I shall call C3 dagger, right? That is an operator that creates, or well, let's call it C1 dagger. This creates a particle, C for creation, dagger because we like to, you know, the sign conventions are always chosen in the least convenient way. For example, think of our wonderful friend Franklin, who decided that the electron would have negative charge. Right, great. So the things that transport the current have negative charge, so the current always goes in the opposite direction to the thing that's actually moving. It's crazy. But of course, he didn't know. So it would have been very nice if this were the creation operation and this would be its adjoint. But we don't do that. This is the creation operator. Okay? Right. So let's define this operator by saying the following. When it applies, when it's applied to this state, which is the vacuum, so what's the vacuum? The vacuum is where I have no particles. So I have some state where there are no particles at all in the system. And when I act on it with this operator, I get the state with one particle so let's say it's the end. So I have one particle in the nth state. Okay? Or another way of looking at it is, which maybe is maybe it's more useful, is that I have my states 1, 2, 3, 4. And basically, if I, for example, apply C1, then that means that the first state has one particle and all the other states have zero particles, right? So this vacuum state would be one where all the states have zero. Okay, so this is my notation for the states, right? A state is a sequence of zeros and ones. I can use zeros and ones because they are fermions. If they were bosons, some states would have 5 bosons or 5,000. But let's stick with fermions.
Can you just write those two states above in this new notation?
Yeah, you're right. I changed the notation, didn't I?
Yeah.
Right, so this would be...
Leave them in the old notation and write what they would be in the new notation, I think.
All right. So that would be... Sorry, this is what you get with no preparation. But I'm realizing along the way, no, that notation is not so good. So that would be... So if this is the first state, second state, third state, and so on, that will have a 1 here, a 0, and a 0. And then the second state will be 1, 2...
Are you sure this is your new notation? I think the new notation actually is just a single state for this whole thing.
Oh, yes, yes, sorry. No, this is not my notation, sorry. No, no, I cannot write... Sorry, sorry. Sam, I cannot write this in this notation because this is already the second quantized notation, and that's first quantized.
Yes, but you can write what the first quantized notation state would be in the second quantized notation.
Right, yes. So this would be just... so if these are my states, this would be 1, 0, 1, and then all the others are empty. Sorry, I understand your question. While this state would be... It will have one particle in the first state, and then all the other single particle states will be empty. Okay? Yeah, sorry. Okay. So basically, we start with our first quantized states, which is this one, and this, which is a Schlesinger determinant for two particles, one in the first, in the state 1 and the other in the state 3, which could be wave vector 1, K1, and wave vector K3, for example, or the first site and the third site in a chain of sites, or something like that. And then what the point we made earlier is that those could be written in this kind of fashion, where you just enumerate which states are occupied and which ones are empty. And you don't have to worry about the order of the particles. In fact, from this state, you cannot tell what particle is which, right? Which is as it should be, because nature cannot tell which particle is which, right? And now what I need is a way of doing everything in terms of this notation. And the problem is my Hamiltonian does not work in that notation because the Hamiltonian is written for specific particles. It has terms that do something to the first particle, something to the second particle, and so on. So obviously if I just tell you this, I don't know straight away how to operate with this Hamiltonian on that state. So I'm going to create define operators that act on these states, and then the idea is to write the Hamiltonian in terms of these new operators. Okay? And you could say, well, right, you've made your state look much simpler, but now your operators will make the Hamiltonian look devilishly complicated to compensate. And the beauty of it is that they won't. And that's why this is useful. Okay? So, I start with the vacuum, which is where all the states have zero occupation, and I apply the operator that creates a particle in state 1, for example, and I define it as giving me this other state where the first state has an occupation of 1. Right, and now what I want, so I fished out some very old notes, and I want to make sure that I'm not getting any normalization factors missing. No. And now what I would want is to act on this state with another operator, C dagger 3, which creates a particle in state 3, and then I get that, okay? So in terms of this, within this second quantized terminology, it is quite evident what I mean, right? If I take a state which has certain occupations of the different single particle states, and I apply a creation operator, it will put an additional particle in one of the states, the one that the creation operator is acting on, right? But the problem with this is that I still don't know how the Hamiltonian could be written in terms of those. So because the Hamiltonian is written in terms of first quantization, I need to work out what my creation annihilation operators look like in first quantized language, right? And this is what you do. So suppose you have some. Let's do it with one. With say that state. So let's call it. Right. So there are two ways of writing this, and to be honest, one is good for certain things, and the other is good for the others. One is you just give the occupation numbers of all the single particle states. The other is you give a list of which single particle states are occupied. Right? So for example, this one where the first and third states are occupied, that could be also written as simply 1, 3, which is the list of states that are occupied. Okay? It's completely equivalent, right? Right. Okay. So let's take, for example, that state in first quantized notation, and we apply the operator that creates the third state, that adds a particle in the third state. Then, of course, we know it has to give this state, right? But we have to define it in some, square root of 2, in some clear way. So let's just say that we're going to stick a particle in the third state in the front, and of course, then it has to have the other term for anti-symmetrization, right? Now, let's suppose that we now want to add another particle, a third particle, in, say, the fifth state. So this, of course, would be 1, 3. So if we want to add a fifth state, then we define it in exactly the same way. So we take first that state, and we stick the fifth state particle in the front, and then we add the terms we need for the thing to be anti-symmetric. So we would have, say, 3, 1, but now with a particle in the fifth state in the front. And now we realize this is not a Slater determinant of three particles, because it only has two terms, it should have 6. And also, it's quite clear that it's not anti-symmetric, and they're swapping the first particle for one of the other two. So therefore, we need to add some terms. So, for example, there's a term that you obtain from here by swapping particles 5 and particles 1 and 2, the first and second particles. So that must have a minus sign, because I've done one swap. And there's a term that I get from here by swapping the first and second particles again. So that has to have a minus sign again, because I've done a swap, but that had a minus sign, so it will have a plus sign. And then I'm missing two more terms, which I can obtain by swapping the second and third particle in this state. So that introduces yet another minus sign, so that's now a plus. And again, doing the same thing, the second and third particle are swapped and a minus sign. Right, and then I have to put the normalization factor in the front, which is going to be 1 over square root of 6, because now there are 6 terms. So if I want the total normalization to be correct, I need to obtain that. Right, and this, of course, you now recognize, is of course a Slater determinant, and is the Slater determinant corresponding to states 1, 3, and 5 being occupied. Or in the other alternative notation that I'm using, where I just give the occupation numbers, I have to give the occupation numbers for states 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and so on. So 1 is occupied, 3 is occupied, 5 is occupied, and all the others have 0 occupation. Okay? Now, and the reason why I'm doing it explicitly in terms of first quantization, instead of just saying this, is that there's something interesting about what happens if I apply a creation operator, for example, and I put in a few particles. And well, first of all, I need annihilation operators as well. I need to remove particles. Because, for example, if I try to describe a term in a Hamiltonian that moves a particle from one place to another, I need to first remove it and then put it back in a different state. Okay, sorry about that. Right. But also, what's very important is that according to this I need to know what happens when I add a particle and then in one state and then add another particle in a different state. So I fill those two states in a certain order, or I do it in the opposite order. And the problem is that there will be a sign. So even though I am perfectly fine describing this, if I had first created the particle in the third state here, and then I had added the particle in the first state, perhaps I wouldn't have got the same. Okay? And and you can tell because the way I've defined this, that I stick the particle in the front, it's only one way of describing it in first quantization. I could have stuck the particle at the back. And at most, all such procedures will give me a valid slater determinant, but there might be a sign change. So I need to stick with first quantization a little bit to determine that. And then once that has been determined, you will see that then we can forget completely about first quantization and we just need to worry about this creation and annihilation operators and a very simple description of the states. Is that clear? Right. So let me do another one. Oh, okay, and let's just do a check because it's 12 o'clock. We do have the room for another half.